My guests are in front of me from Cambridge Citizens Advice Bureau. Lorraine Payne. Good morning, Lorraine.
Yes, good morning, Lee.
And Richard Curtis. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you're here to talk about energy providers switching and billing problems. This is a thorny area, isn't it? Do you get a lot of inquiries about this subject?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, since October, we've seen 60 people in the Bureau doing one-to-ones. Outside of that, we do get, you know, people phone up and other people inquire. I mean, we've also done some talks out in the community as well. There's a lot of interest, and the people that are willing to sort of look into it and engage are saving themselves, you know, a lot of money.
What are the most kind of common queries that you get then, Lorraine?
I'd say requests for help with switching is a big one at the moment. And we think there must have been a batch of annual statements going out around about now, because in the last couple of weeks, we've had a pickup in the number of calls and queries we've received. So help with switching would be one. Problems with direct debits, problems with billing, estimated bills where we don't get that. The meters aren't read as often as they perhaps once were. I know smart meters are coming in, but they're not widespread yet. So there's lots of estimated bills out there, and people sometimes get a nasty shock when the meter is actually read. And you know, they find they might be fortunate and find that there's a credit, but often they might have underestimated, and there's quite a balance to be paid to bring the account up to date.
So let's just kind of clarify the situation, just backpedal a little bit. There are numerous suppliers now of gas and electricity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In a way that there weren't before. Before, you got it from British Gas or from National Electric or something like that. And now there are how many suppliers?
Oh, well, there's the big six still, which still dominate the market. But there's a whole raft of new energy companies that you know, OVO, First Utility, Richard, ones that
you've,
you can think of.
Well, you've got Robinhood Energy. You've got almost each time you do a comparison for someone, there's one I've never heard of before. You know, they're coming out of the woodwork. So yeah, there's a lot out there.
So
yeah.
How do you choose the supplier that's right for you?
Okay. I mean, one is you need that accurate bill. That's the first step that you've got to have. And as Lorraine said, the estimation part of it, you know, it can make a big, big difference. So, you know, if you've not done one for a while, then to do that, get off that estimated and do an actual reading to generate an actual bill. That's the first step.
So you have the exact amount that you've spent per quarter on electricity.
Yeah,
and gas.
I mean, because the energy company does not, by law, have to read your meter for 2 years.
2 years?
Mm. So you could be going for all of that time, and we've seen examples of that, whereas, you know, that it's estimated all the way, and it can either be, you know, to the good or the bad in terms of your bill. I mean, I had a gentleman who had £1,000 credit. When they said, well, read your bill, it then swung the other way completely, and it was a -265. So that just shows you know, what you should have. So the first thing is the accurate bill. Once you've got the accurate bill, you've then got all the relevant information that you're going to need. So the name of the tariff, the date it's going to end, if there's any exit fees on there, your last 12 months actual usage in kilowatt hours will be on there as well. That is really key. You just need your postcode, because not all the energy suppliers supply to every address in the country. And then you use an Ofgem approved comparison site, a couple of which, I mean, if you go on the Go Energy site, goenergy.com, they've got them listed on there. But a couple just to mention, a Money Supermarket and also Uswitch are just a couple that you can use. And it will just ask you for all the information I've just talked about. You just fill in the boxes. It will probably take you 5 minutes, 5 to 10 minutes to do that exercise. And then you hit the button and it gives you the results. And
it'll tell you if there's a supplier that would be cheaper for you.
It would. It tells you what the saving would be for the year. There are a few other. It really does depend on how you want to pay as well. That really does come into it. So the biggest savings will be for those who want to pay by monthly direct debit or even quarterly direct debit. As soon as you've got that direct debit element in there, then you start to see the big savings. But even if you don't want, you know, neither of those are suitable for you, if you wanted to, as a, for instance, pay every quarter when you get the bill, and you just go in and pay by cash at the post office, then it's still about looking for that best deal on the method of payment that you actually pay by. And then, obviously, if you want to switch, then you can. The other one thing just to warn people about is the Warm Home Discount. So it's £140, which is given to people between September and the end of March. But not all of the companies actually administer that. So although you might be entitled to it, and those who get the guaranteed element of the pension credit are those who would definitely get it, and it's applied to your, say, your electric bill as a credit, £140. But the big six definitely do it. So E.ON, Empower, British Gas, they'll all do it. And some of the smaller ones, but not all. So someone could look and say the comparison site tells them they could save £100. Well, if they are getting it at the moment through their actual company, switch to one without, then that's £140 they're going to lose. So that's quite a big mistake that you could make. But certainly the Money Supermarket has got it quite clearly down the right-hand column, tells you whether the company is actually in the Warm Home Discount Scheme or not.
And how much have people saved by switching?
Well, I mean, I've seen 60 people since October the 1st. Average savings, £330.
A year?
Yeah, a year. And that's a really, you know...
That's a substantial amount of money, isn't
it? Yeah, absolutely. And obviously what it's doing, it's fixing it for at least 12 months. You can get fixes for up to 3 years, but generally it's around about 12 months that it's fixing for. So it's the unit price that is fixed as well, not the direct debit. That's, again, something that people get a little bit confused about. So it's the unit price of the gas or the electrics that's being fixed. So obviously if you do use more during that year, then you will pay more. But as long as you keep the same usage, then you will see the saving that you've seen in the comparison site.
You mentioned confusion there, and it can be a little bit confusing, can't it, Lorraine? I mean, particularly for older people.
Yes, it can be. I think people find it a little bit bewildering as well. And I think a lot of people want to switch, but they lack that confidence to take the plunge. So Richard and I are both available through the Bureau if people need a bit of hand-holding or just want to sit down and go through the process, so we can explain the process to them in more detail. Happy to do that. As you say, I think generally what when people first contact us, we'd say, right, okay, let's get that accurate bill, because we don't want to do a lot of work on estimated figures. So we would say to people, right, okay, so we'll book an appointment to see you in perhaps 2 weeks' time. And in the meantime, you submit, if you're able to do that yourself, or perhaps a friend or neighbour or a family member might help you to read the meter and to submit that to your energy company, so that you get an accurate bill. So by the time we meet, we've got that accurate information that we need to go ahead and help people with the switching.
Well, some people feel loyal to their suppliers, though, don't they?
They do, unfortunately. And I wish that loyalty was rewarded in some way, or at least recognised, but it doesn't seem to be. Someone once said to me, oh, computers don't understand loyalty. And I think that's a good point, really. It isn't appreciated. Often loyalty is sort of taken to be laziness, really. And, you know, the big providers, the insurance companies, energy companies, they regard people as being lazy, and therefore they think that you'll accept any old deal, you know, when there are a lot better deals out there, just for a little bit of work.
So if I come to you and you look at my bill and you say, actually, you could get a better deal elsewhere, how easy is it to switch?
I think it's very, very straightforward. So if I talk to you about the people who have come in to see me and I have helped switch. So from that comparison, so you need to do no further work in terms of putting all the figures in again. Literally down the side of the comparison will be a switch now. You hit that button and literally ask you for a few more details, bank account details, contact details in terms of telephone number and address, and then you hit the button. So literally from start to finish.
You can do that all on those websites?
Absolutely.
And you're not going to get called by British Gas or whoever your old supplier saying, why have you switched? I think that's what worries people. They're going to be hassled by
it. No, you get no contact. So the dealings really are with the new one. Your old one cannot stop you going unless you've got arrears. if you've got arrears and you're on a normal meter, you would have to settle that final bill before you went. You know, that's sort of the important one. If you've got a prepayment meter, you can actually switch if you've got up to £500 worth of debt, because obviously it's all on the prepayment meter. But yeah, as long as you're, you know, within that, then you can switch. That's not a problem. So you'll deal with just the new one. You've got a 14-day cooling off period as well, when you actually hit the button. 14, so nothing will happen. They'll just contact you to say, we've got your details. 14 days is what you've got to change your mind. But once that 14 days is up, they're very, very quick now to get the switching process underway. I mean, Lorraine's known of people who've literally switched within 3 days of that 14 days being up. And certainly I've heard within like a week to 2 weeks as well. So it is a very, very quick, you know, sort of process. So you'll get nominated a switch day. On that switch day, it's important to read the meters, the gas and electric. Then you give your old company and your new company those figures. So your old company can bill you up to date, and then your new one knows going forward where to take the meter reading from.
And are there any other things to consider? I mean, we were talking about prices. Is there anything other that you should be considering? We don't really have much contact with your energy suppliers other than price, but I wonder, is there service that you should be considering? Or?
There are some, you know, as I say, there are, I think on the comparison sites, some of them do have a customer service rating. So, you know, some people, you know, if that's very important to you, and yes, I mean, we want good customer service, then you might choose to filter your results by the companies that have got a particularly high sort of rating, customer service rating. So that would be one thing. Perhaps, as Richard mentioned, methods of payment. Generally, the cheapest deals are for direct debit customers. That doesn't suit everyone. So, as I say, it's a case of shopping around to get the best deal. Lots of suppliers out there, and let's make them work for our customers.
Well, there are lots of suppliers out there, and there are sometimes names of companies that you've never heard of, but they're supplying gas and electric. Can we trust them?
Yes, I don't have any doubts about that. There'd all be, you know, there's a lot of regulation, you know, in the energy market, and as you say, they're all, you know, highly regulated firms. I think if you had any doubts, then I'd go onto the Ofgem website and check them out. Check out the company's website. You know, as I say, it's your choice. It has to be something that you're happy with. We're happy to set out. We set out the options for people. But we don't make any recommendations as to which you know, supplier anyone should go with.
And how often can you switch? So say you switch and then you, 6 months later you think, oh, well, I'll compare again. Oh, that's just cheaper. Can you switch again?
You can. I mean, I think the thing to bear in mind is it's really what tariff you're on and whether you've got exit fees or not. So you've got to bear those in mind. So there are quite a lot out there without any exit fees. And I would say if you've got no exit fees on your tariff, I'd be looking every sort of 3 to 6 months.
That frequently?
Yeah. I mean, a colleague of mine, I won't name her, but she knows who it is. she switched. I helped her switch in November. And we then ran a comparison last week. Now, she could save, when we did the one in November, she saved over £200. And then we actually did a comparison and say last week she could save a further 137. So,
wow.
Just shows you.
Yes.
So if you've got exit fees on there, now some are very, very small exit fees. So E.ON, as a for instance, just have a, you know, on some of theirs have a £5 one. So if you had a £5 per fuel, some have a £30 per fuel, and that's about the biggest exit fee that you'll see. But then take it into consideration. I mean, if you're going to save £300 through switching, but the exit fee is £20, £30, well, obviously, it's then worth switching. But there are some of the websites, if you do switch, so go through uSwitch. There's another one through Money Saving Expert, which actually uses Money Supermarket. They will actually notify you of, so if you say, I want to be saving, to switch again, I want to be saving £100, then they will email you to tell you that there's a tariff on the market which is suitable to switch. So you get that information sent to you.
So The secret is to think of this as a purely commercial relationship, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, that's how the energy companies see it. And I think for us to be sort of, you know, loyal, it's really not in our best interest. You know, we need to keep them, keep them focused and keep them getting the best deal for us.
Oh, well, thank you so much for coming in. I'm going to get on that website straight away, I tell you. So if people want more information, you mentioned a couple of websites there. Was it YouSwitch?
YouSwitch. I mean, if people actually... the one to go through is goenergyshopping.co.uk. So that's all one word. So www.goenergyshopping.co.uk. They will give the Ofgem approved sites, of which there's about 11 or 12 of them. Also, at the moment, if people go through Martin Lewis's site, Money Saving Expert, then you will. The one they use is the Money Supermarket one. And if you've got two fuels that you're switching, they will actually give you £30 cash back in 3 months' time. So that's quite a nice little incentive as well, on top of the saving that you'd make by switching.
Excellent. Okay, and you need an accurate bill really to do that, but you can request a bill at any stage, presumably.
Yes, as I say, I'd provide a meter reading, and it should generate an up to date bill if they've been estimated readings for some time. But if not, as I say, we can just call the energy companies and ask for an up to date bill.
And I think if there's one further point that I could make to people is even if you're on a fixed tariff now, as soon as that fixed tariff ends, you are automatically put onto a standard variable tariff, which is, you know, costs you a lot more money, and a lot of people just don't realise that.
Oh, thank you so much for coming in. That has been such an eye-opener. Thank you very much.
100 Nights of Dirty Dancing are on the road at the moment, and I'm talking to one of the kingpins, actually, of the whole thing. The producer is vitally important for getting these productions together, and on the road and on the phone with me right now is Phil Hawkins. Good morning to you, Phil.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. We caught you in a little bit of a situation at the moment. You're sitting in a barber's chair somewhere. You've got to get these haircuts in sometime.
Literally on the road as we speak, sat in a barber's as we speak.
Is this a mobile barber's then? Is this a mobile barber's or is this a barber's sort
it's
of...
It's not, no, it's a barber's just where I am in England, who seemed like nice chaps. So I popped in here to get my mop dealt with.
One day when this is all over, Phil, you'll have to write a book, you know, the 100 best barbers around Britain or something like that.
Absolutely, that I visited. Service stations and barbers.
Life that must be like that for you at the moment. You're doing still, I think, about 3 weeks more of the tour around the UK, and you're coming to Cambridge on Friday. How's it going so far?
Yeah, the cast are doing fantastically well. Numbers have been very good, sort of cross-board, which is great, as in audience numbers. And the cast themselves, I mean, the show normally, it's a very organic thing, so it normally takes 2 weeks to really find its feet. You know, it's like learning to drive. You learn to drive, but it's only when you're on the road that you really learn. And it's the same as the show. You rehearse it, you put it together. But with a show like this, where there's no fourth wall, it's very much when the audience is there that the show begins to really find its form.
I can see that.
So they're now, Well, they're now settling in very much with it. It's because every night with this show is very different because there is no fourth wall, so the audience become part of the show. So obviously, it always means that if you go to watch a performance, you are watching a very individual performance.
And each stage, Phil, is each, I guess you're not doing any one particular venue more than once. Are you sort of selling out sometimes to do two or three nights at any one place?
There's a couple of venues where we've got two nights in, but because it's essentially a one-night tour, so it's essentially, you know, in one venue, do your show, back in your tour bus, drive a couple of hours, stay in a hotel, get up, drive a few hours, next venue. So it's a tiring life on the road.
Do you sometimes take tour buses and actually sleep in them, or are you making sure that everyone gets their head down on the sack, so to speak, after each night's performance?
They've got a very nice bus, but it's not a sleeper coach. But we have if you see us on the road, it's a big black Easy Theatres tour bus, blacked out windows. So if you see us, give us a hoot.
You've got your own. Yeah, so Easy Theatres, which is the production company behind yourselves, isn't it, that stages these things. You were in town last week with another one of your productions, which was with the Bee Gees and ABBA, doing a tribute night, which was went down a storm in Cambridge last Friday. It's this Friday that you come to see us. Is this the first time yourself that you've established yourself in the Cambridge Corn Exchange for any production, Phil? Have you been there before?
I've been to Cambridge twice before in my career. I'm trying to remember what shows they were. I'm old now. I'm 37. I have a weird memory of me and my girl being one of them. We would have been talking a good few years ago. But I've been to Cambridge twice in my career. Lovely venue. It'd be been very nice to return.
And there were seven of them performing last week. There were three of them as the Bee Gees, and four of them, of course, doing the two girls and the two boys playing the parts of the various roles in ABBA. How many are you taking on tour with you at the moment, Phil?
The Dirty Dancing cast has a cast of 12, and myself, so 13 at the moment with us, but 12 in the cast. You've got your Johnny and your baby characters portrayed by Darius James and Eloise Gray, ironically. And then you have two hosts, Max Kellerman and Lisa Houseman, who are essentially, they're like our cement that holds the whole thing together, if you will.
Is this being done as a narrative so that Kellerman is sort of standing on stage and then sort of talks us through the story?
We introduce the audience to be part of the story. So for those of you who are listening who've seen the film, at the end of the film, you'll know it's the Kellerman's end of season talent show. And our production takes place as the curtains open. The audience are invited to become the Kellerman's end of season talent audience. So they become part of the production from the word go, which is why I know two productions are the same. Because, you know, there's always a little point in there where a particular poor gentleman will come and join us on stage. And obviously you can never orchestrate entirely how that's going to go. And that's always entertaining because some guys are, you know, really excited to get up there and others are terrified. So it's a lot of fun.
Has anybody really stood out then that's come up on the stage then from the audience?
We did have a gentleman once. I appreciate we're on the radio, but this has been in a completely innocent way, but we had a gentleman once, and what we do is our Lisa character will say, I need a man, with a gorgeous manly name, and Leo, who plays Max Kellerman, goes into the audience, he'll find a man, and he said to this one particular man, what's your name, sir? And the man said, Dick. And you can imagine that in a theatre you had 90% female audience, and of all the names in the world, we had a field day with him. He was a lovely gentleman as well. He was Dick, but no, it's just a lot of fun. It really is. It's very, you know, it's tongue in cheek. It pays respect to the original story and gives it the sort of dignity and respect it deserves, without portraying it just like the film. You know, we have to make it our own. So.
Well, somebody has to be called Richard after all. But the dancing side of things. So I guess you've got a small dance troupe. The chorus line, for want of a better phrase, that support the main two dancers at the front of stage as well. When do you start sort of going into production like this? I know that you had literally hundreds, perhaps even thousands of people rolling up for auditions to get on the road with you for Dirty Dancing, and presumably this whole
1,200.
My goodness.
Yeah.
And how long ago was that? 1,200 and something?
I was receiving applications from, I think, August of last year, or maybe June of last year. And then I had applications open until, auditions were in November. So literally in the space of the sort of four or five months, I received 1,270-odd CVs, which I then wheedled down to 100, and then wheedled down again to 50, and then invited 50 to an audition.
And you sit through all of the auditions yourself, Phil, or do you have, some very good talented people in their own right to do the talent spotting for you?
I tend to sift through and pick whom I'd like to see. However, this time I admit my choreographer, Alex Rose, who is fantastic and has been with me for a long time now. Alex takes over a lot of that for me now, because I produce not just Dirty Dancing, but I produce You Win Again, which is a story of the Bee Gees, and The Power of Love, which is a story of Celine Dion, comes out later this year. So it's lots of different things that I do. So I definitely need the Alexes around me to help me, if you will.
So you do these things by rotation, these productions, I guess. That keeps you busy right across the year, Phil. And you certainly...
Yeah.
You put in the miles, that's one thing.
Yeah.
Along with the rest of the cast. Do some of them audition again
today.
You're down in Cornwall at the moment, so you've got quite a long ride to get up to Cambridge. You've got obviously somewhere on the way for tomorrow evening. And members of the cast that have been in this production, Dirty Dancing, do they sometimes audition to come round again in another one of your productions?
They do, yeah. A few of my cast have been with me. They did the premiere of You Win Again, which was at Cliffs Pavilion, South End, that sold out. And some of the cast are in this, well, with the premiere for that. And You Win Again is off to Singapore straight after Dirty Dancing. And some of the two of the cast of this will be with that. And then You Win Again tours England and Germany early next year. And I'll probably use two or three. I tend to, if I get a group of people around me, essentially like a rep company, you could say the Easy Theatres rep company, essentially. You know, if there's a group of trusted performers that work really well, and then I will always offer them the work. It's a hard game, so it's nice to have a bunch of people around you.
Yeah, sort of like the top core level people. And I was going to use the word trust as well, the people that you know you can rely on, going to give you a good performance, will learn new dance moves and dance steps and lines very well, and give you, well, turn out a good performance on stage night after night. So you've still got three weeks to go. You're probably going to be paying the tip of the barber, so we'll let you go very shortly, Phil. But what sort of things are we going to... I mean, obviously, without giving too much away, in terms of songs, we're going to hear She's Like the Wind, Big Girls Don't Cry, Hey Baby, Wipeout.
You will literally hear every major song from the film, but you will hear them in the context of how I've written the show, without giving too much away.
Yeah, of course.
So they'll all be there. they'll all be there.
Along with yourself, Phil, thank you very much for your time. I'm conscious you probably want to now get back into the wagon and get yourself down to where it is you're going to be playing in Cornwall this evening. But if people want to catch this one, I'll just give the listeners some details about what they can do before we go to the travel news. Tickets are £24, Phil, and also concessions are £18. The box office in Cambridge is 357851. It's a Cambridge number, 01223 357851. And also the website where you can order your tickets as well, find out more information about the production for this coming Friday evening, A Night of Dirty Dancing. It's cornex.co.uk, and the production's being put on by Easy Theatres. Well, hopefully, Phil, you'll be back in Cambridge later in the year with the next production. You never know if you can book one for the Corn Exchange as well. As I said last week, you find it a great venue, and the Cambridge crowd are a great crowd. They'll be rolling up, and we'll find somebody for you when they go on the stage and make a nice fool of themselves in a tongue-in-cheek sort of way. But thank you very much once again, Phil, for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. That was Phil Hawkins there, who's the producer of this coming Friday evening's production. Go and get your tickets to go along and have a good time.
My next guest is here, Ros Fitzgerald. So this Sunday sees the 162nd boat race and the 71st women's boat race. And as you know, the boat race is a side-by-side rowing competition between the University of Oxford, and sometimes known as the Dark Blues, and the University of Cambridge, sometimes referred to as the Light Blues. Last year, in 2015, it made history by having the women's Oxford and Cambridge first team compete the same day as the men's. And it will be the first time in history this year, in 2016, that all four senior races, the men's, the women's, men's reserves and women's reserves, will take place the same day for the ex-Oxford and Cambridge boat race. Now, watched by thousands, it will be along the banks of the Tideway between Putney and Mortlake in London. And we're watched by millions on TV around the world. And so it is partly sponsored by the Cancer Research UK this year, a unique sporting event
event with every strong quad of athletes expected to be thrilling again once a year. And my guest, Ross Fitzgerald, is a Cambridge-based rower. She has taken part in many, many events, including the, I'm going to big you up here, Ross, Henley Women's Regatta, the Henley Masters to the Masters National Championships, where Ross received a bronze medal. And she is here to talk about women's rowing and sport, if we touch on it as well, women's sport in particular, how crucial it has been in her life to have sport. Welcome, Ros. Nice to see you.
Thank you.
Oh, nice to have you. Glad you're local, which is great. Fantastic. Can we start with the most historic race, of course? I've just been talking about the Oxford and Cambridge Broad Race taking place this year. So as experience, what insight do you have about the Oxford and Cambridge boat race? What do you feel about it?
I don't envy the squad members their training regime at all for this event. I mean, not only will they be spending time on the water, but they'll also be doing strength and conditioning work, meeting targets on the ergo, the rowing machine, monitoring their nutrition. Training's also built around their academic commitments, so that they're really stretched. The CAM just isn't big enough to accommodate the depth and breadth of the water work that they really require for this event.
Right.
So they regularly go off to Ely. They go off on the very early morning train. They put in work over there. They come back. They go to lectures and tutorials. Then the next break they get, they'll be back doing physical endurance work, ready for this big event.
So is that, you probably don't know, but is it the same for Oxford, that they have to go to another place to
train? I don't
know. To train?
I don't know enough about Oxford.
No, that's fine.
Here,
yeah.
I'm familiar with the Cambridge work.
We're concentrating on Cambridge. But that's really interesting. So they have to take themselves off to Ely to...
Yeah. It's a great shame that Cambridge hasn't really invested in developing a rowing lake. And the growth of rowing in this area means that the CAM is very, very busy.
Yeah, of course.
If anybody on the towpath first thing in the morning when the college crews are out, that the amount of work that you can do is really limited to short bursts, because you're then in the back of a queue waiting for the next boat to go off and so on. And I mean, they've divided it up now into men's and women's sessions at various times, and they've got very strict rules about when you can go out, but that is quite limiting. And time on the water is not time wasted any more than any other training that you do. Becoming a cohesive crew requires that time on the water.
Mm, good word, cohesive, because that is something that is a must, isn't it?
Yeah.
When you're rowing Cambridge, or if you're rowing anywhere,
anywhere.
So I think it's fantastic to see women finally getting the same place, the same day as the men's. And do you think that it has a positive, I'm sure it does have a positive effect on clubs, rowing clubs in Cambridge, do you think? Have you seen more women participate?
I think the boat race certainly attracts a lot of media coverage, yes. And it's great to see women getting media coverage. It's just a shame that they're not given the same coverage as the men's boat.
Interesting.
You see on the day, all the focus will be on the big race, the men's race.
Mm.
You know, last year they did it, they touch on the women's races, but they don't give them the precedence that they really deserve. Seeing women in a competitive environment really spurs me on, and I'm sure this has the same effect on others. And I suspect all sports clubs get a surge of inquiries after a major event, whether it be cycling, rowing, gymnastics, anything. There'll be this big surge, and it tails off a little bit, but you always get those that stay and continue to work at it and get a lot of enjoyment out of it.
That's good. I mean, it's good that the women's race is going to be the first one, isn't it? That's 3:10.
Yeah.
As opposed to, because in rugby, the men's rugby, it's the first big match, and then you have the women's rugby after the match. And I've been at rugby matches and everyone has just literally disappeared, and you have a few people, maybe a few thousand, watching the women's, but actually it would be so good to see a whole packed venue at Twickers. So I'm really pleased that the women is first, if that makes... Do you think it maybe get a bit more coverage? But I mean, last year was the first.
Maybe a little. I think, you know, that area down by the river will be packed. So yes, but I think... Generally speaking, people are far more interested in the men's race than the women's race.
So how are we going to change that? How do you think that's...
Just keep plugging away. Just proving ourselves.
Yes.
And being proactive in sport.
Yes.
I think for women it gets harder because we go off and we get married and we run homes and raise families and do jobs, and trying to fit everything is very difficult. But we've just got to keep our foot in the door and keep wedging it open.
Yeah, by encouraging more people, more women and mums, and
Getting youngsters involved at an early age.
That's right. Yeah. Do you have many school children coming to the clubs to do the rowing?
Oh, yeah, I think most of the larger town clubs have got a junior section. Mm. And there's a lot of junior rowing in Cambridge, not just from the schools, but individuals coming to clubs generally and doing very, very well. Mm. If you talk to some of the coaches around at the bigger clubs here, they've got juniors going off to all sorts of events all over the country.
Oh, that's
including
good.
National competitions.
And you find are you talking about the women, girls as such, or are you talking about both girls and boys in this?
Girls and boys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's good. So if we come on, Roz, to, you are a role model. I'm going to put you as a role model because you started late. Is that right?
I did start late.
Which is, for me, is fantastic because I was just saying to you earlier before when you came in, it makes me feel as if you can do it anytime. You can start an sport anytime you like, can't you? You don't have to be experienced when you were younger. I mean, you said yourself that you didn't have much sporting experience,
no,
did you?
I did the usual school sports, you know, the netball, the hockey, that sort of stuff. Can't say I was very keen on any of it, nor was I particularly good at any of it. But it was a change in my personal circumstances that got me into rowing. I mean, my marriage fell apart and I found myself on my own with my 17-year-old son. And I was 42. I was very fortunate that my neighbours, the landlords then of the Free Press, Chris and Debbie Lloyd, were very, very kind to me and took me under their wing and encouraged me to join in with things that they were part of. And they, of course, they also ran the Free Press Boat Club. So I got introduced to lots of rowing-orientated people. Got conned a little bit into going and coxing a boat because I'd lost quite a lot of weight. I was only 5'6" and I weighed...
Well, you still are 5'6".
Well, yes, I still am 5'6", but I weighed 53 kilos by then. So I was a real lightweight.
Yeah.
And I think they looked at me and thought, cox, you know, very light. She's not going to be heavy to tow along. So they conned me into going and getting in a boat one morning and steering it. And it was quite nice. It was a beautiful day. I saw kingfishers on the river. Mm. You know, it was beautiful, blissful. They asked me back, so I can't have been too bad. And then about the third or fourth time out, they had me cox them in a regatta.
Wow.
And we won. And I got a trophy and free beer. Well, that was it. I was hooked then.
We won't talk about the beer, but actually I'm sure that had an effect. But actually, Ross, can you just tell us a little bit about cox, the position, and what you actually have to do? Because if we're watching the boat race on Sunday, and we spend a lot of our time looking at the rowers, which they are equally as important, but it is quite crucial to have a spot on cox, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, there are coxless crews. Mm. So smaller boats are very often coxless, but with an eight, like you're going to get in the boat race, you've got to have somebody steer it.
Yeah.
And you've got to have somebody that can gel that crew together and can see what's happening around them and use all that information to spur that crew on and keep them cohesive, keep them motivated. It's a long way and there's some bits on that river where it's almost boring and you sort of zone out a little bit, and that cox is there keeping that focus, keeping that drive, keeping that encouragement, even when you're not maybe doing quite as well as you could do. Bring it back, grounding you, getting you back to where you need to be in your race plan.
Yeah, so I'm watching the that position on Sunday for both of them. Have you met any of the teams? Have they ever come and visited the I'm going to say it now, I've got to get this right, haven't I, the Canterbrigians, is that right?
Yeah, Canterbrigians.
Have they come in and have you had some sort of association with them? Do they come in and talk to...
Over the years, we've had some of those rowers come through the club and all the town clubs. Those that have remained in Cambridge have perhaps become, as they've got older, more active with local clubs, touching on them. But their level of sport is way, way above what most of us do in the town clubs.
And you were saying that the Cambridge have to go to Ely. Where do you practice?
Just here on the camp.
You do?
Yeah. But I mean, sometimes we get training days. Well, we'll go maybe to Peterborough. We've got links with Peterborough. And they've, of course, got the rowing lake at Peterborough, which is multi-lane. That's quite useful for training purposes. We've been off. We've done the bit of river that the Cambridge crews use over at Ely.
Oh,
and I've been on rowing camps out of the country. I've been to Banyoles in Spain for a couple of seasons and rowed there.
Oh, that was coming on to my next question, because I'm going to ask you, what has been your greatest achievement since starting the rowing? You're looking up now.
I mean,
bronze medal?
Getting the bronze medal at the Masters was terrific.
Yeah.
And I was really pleased with that. But I think, you know, even much more locally, getting my blades at bumps. So provided you've gone up every night, so you've improved your station each evening in the bumps.
What are the bumps? Sorry, can you just explain the bumps?
Oh, bumps is a rather terrifying affair, especially when you're new to it.
Right.
Where all the boats line up on the river down at the start, you're a boat length apart, or just over a boat length apart, a gun goes off to tell you when it's time to go, and you all set off at the same time. And the idea is to try and catch the boat in front of you before you're caught by the boat chasing you.
Oh, goodness.
And you gradually move up, hopefully move up each evening. Of course, it sometimes goes the other way and you go down as well. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah.
Sounds very exciting, actually.
It is very, very exciting. It's wonderful to watch. I mean, the college do it as well, the colleges. So they have bumps twice a year. They do Lent bumps and May bumps. But town only gets one strike at it. And going back to women's rowing, you'll see there how much more men are involved simply by the number of divisions that are dedicated to men's boats compared to women's boats.
Yeah, and he's changing. So Roz, this has helped you, hasn't it, the rowing? Because you've had some personal challenges that you've had to get through. And we're talking about your personal challenges because Cancer UK Research are joint sponsoring the boat race on Sunday.
Yeah.
So it's quite an opportune time, isn't it, for us to talk about Cancer UK?
Yeah.
Because they've helped you, haven't they? Is that right?
Yes, I was unfortunate enough to suddenly find that I'd got breast cancer in February last year. It was a real bolt out of the blue. It was quite progressed, so it was a very large tumour with big spread, and I was told quite clearly that I was going to have some heavy-duty chemotherapy, surgery and radiotherapy. So I've sort of been working my way through that, but all through that I've managed to either cox or row, done bits of training. I perhaps haven't been quite as good as I used to be, and I've had to dip out a couple of times, but I've even raced during the course of my treatment. I was very fortunate to go with the Cambridge Women's Squad, the Veterans Squad here in Cambridge, to Norwich last year and raced during my treatment.
Wow.
And I also ran the Race for Life during my treatment, and I'm not a natural runner, but my friend Joe sort of got me around the course, and we put in a reasonable time, considering I was sort of halfway through chemo and had no hair. So,
oh, wow. Yeah. I remember when you wrote your piece and you emailed to me, I was absolutely taken aback. And as I said to you, you are an absolute inspiration. I think it's fantastic that you're another key role model in everything, that you can do things even though, you know, you have some challenges. You have to try, don't you?
Yes, and I think it's not just about me, it was about all those people around me that have given me that support and encouragement to keep going.
Yeah.
And doing exercise when you're having that treatment's really important.
Mm.
So I can't fault Addenbrookes for their care and support, or the Macmillan team up there, or the Maggie Wallace Centre. All those things came together to get me through it.
Fantastic.
And, you know, the future's bright.
Absolutely. And as I said, you know, you can start any time and you can get through things. As you say, you can tap out of sport, you can come back in. And it's not just for men, it's women's sport. It's out there, isn't it, for girls, old women like me. I'm not going to put you in this, but I'm going to put me in this. And I'm really looking forward to starting the beginners rowing sessions. I think that start in May. What would you say to anyone wanting to get into rowing or wanting to get into sport? For you, obviously, it's going to be rowing because that is your passion, but you've also done running as well, so you've tapped into quite a few things.
There's a lot of variety out there. You know, nothing ventured, nothing gained.
Exactly.
Just have a go.
Mm.
Try them all. Mm. Pick the one that suits you best.
Mm.
You don't have to be good at it. Just enjoy it.
Yeah, that's right. And that's the key, isn't it? You can tap into it, find what you want, and if it doesn't work, you try something else.
Yeah.
We're not geared to do it all, and we're not geared to be good at something all the time.
No, whatever you choose, just enjoy it. The benefits are huge.
Yeah. Roz, thank you very much indeed. It's been a real pleasure having you here. And I know we've been talking about it for a few months and you've been very busy. So I'm really delighted that you came in today and I wish you all the best. Have you got any other future plans that you want to tell us about for rowing as such?
I'd like to set myself goals to work towards. Whether I ever achieve them remains to be seen. But this summer I'm going off on a rowing camp in Portugal. Where I want to really improve my sculling, which is being out in a boat on your own. I quite enjoy sculling. My problem is, despite the fact that I can cox going forward, I can't steer going backwards. So I'm going off to learn to do it properly.
I have to explain, why learning to go backwards? What?
When you're rowing, of course, you're going the wrong way.
Oh, yeah, of course.
So if you're in a boat on your own, you've got to be able to steer and be intuitive about where your boat's going and whether you can keep it in a straight line.
Oh, goodness.
So that you don't run into the bank, which tends to happen on the cam when I go out in a scull. So, that's my goal for this year, is to improve my steering on my own in a scull.
Well, Roz, I wish you all the best. It sounds fantastic. And as I said, you are a role model and it's lovely to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Now, over the last couple of years or so, it's been very much something that's been in the news, brain tumours. You might remember the case last year of that little boy, Asher King, who was taken out of the hospital, I think it was in Southampton, by his parents, taken to Spain and then eventually on to Prague, where he received proton beam therapy treatment for a brain tumour that he had. Well, a little while ago, we were contacted by a young boy called Charlie Nelson. Charlie is now 14. Back in 2012, his brother Rhys sadly died of a brain tumour. And Charlie, since then, has been doing quite a lot of things to raise money for the Brain Tumour Charity. And this weekend, given it's half term at the moment, Charlie is embarking on something which is rather remarkable for anybody to do, but for a 14-year-old, most definitely remarkable. He's riding 300 miles from Addenbrookes up to Hunstanton, and then around the Norfolk coast and the Suffolk coast, and then finishing off 10 days later back here in Cambridge at Addenbrookes. Earlier in the week, as I say, he's only 14, so he's at school. Earlier in the week, both Charlie and his mum, Debbie, came here to Cambridge 105, and I talked to them about his brother and indeed what he's doing at the weekend. So in the studio with me today, I've got Debbie. Debbie is Reese's mum and also Reese's slightly older brother, Charlie. So tell us a little bit about your brother, Reese, or Reesey, I think you often call him.
Yeah, that was your name for him.
Yeah, I had a few nicknames for him. He was Bubble or Reesey or Superstar.
Yeah, so I just called him Reese, but that was more your thing to call him Reesey.
Yeah, and I think it's just picked up from there sort of thing.
Yeah.
So what were the early symptoms in the first place, Debbie, that made you think we need to get this investigated?
Originally, in 2011, he just started to be sick in the mornings. And straight off, you think, oh, it's a bug. Like a lot of children pick up at school. They're not the greatest at washing their hands all the time. So I kept thinking, oh, he's picked up a tummy bug. But then the sickness would go off. He'd be sick and he'd be absolutely fine for the rest of the day. And then I took him to the doctors. One doctor sent us away saying, oh, it's just nerves from starting a new school. Our family GP, Dr. Yip, was absolutely amazing. He sort of said to keep a diary, see if there was any connection to food. There wasn't. And when I went back to see him, he phoned straight through to the L&D hospital, our local one, and said, I think he needs a brain scan. So he was really on it. He was very, very good.
So
Rhys died, I think, was it 2011?
2012. He was diagnosed 2011.
So let's just talk about what you're doing starting at the weekend. So I know this is not the first time that you've raised money for brain tumour charity, Charlie. Tell us a little bit about some of the things that you've done in the past to raise money.
Well, Dad had been... did the marathon beforehand, yeah. And then I felt like I wanted to get involved as well. At Christmas time, I sort of raised loads of sweets and toys to donate to Addenbrookes Hospital, where Rhys had treatment. And then I had a 26-mile walk where I asked for donations, like sponsors for the walk.
And how much did you raise from that?
£2,000.
And what happened with the money that you raised from the sponsored walk?
We gave it to our supporter group that we'd started under the brain tumour charity, the Rhys and Nelson Superstar Fund. So that was what we donated the money to.
Right. And do you find out what happens with the money that you give, or does it just go into a bigger pot?
It generally, I think it goes into a bigger pot, but when we first set up the supporter group, they did say once you reach £10,000 of money raised, you can sort of choose where it goes to. So we put down for paediatric research, because it's so underfunded, all the research for brain tumours is. So, and there's so many worthy areas for it to go to, but we tended to think unless you can treat these brain tumours and beat them, you know, the rehabilitation sort of like, it doesn't, it's still so important, but we want it to be beaten. We want to still have these children here to get the rehabilitation. So, that's where it tends to go when we, any money we raise, it goes to paediatric research.
You've got a big task ahead of you starting on Saturday, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
So who came up with that idea?
Me and my mentor, Mr. Payne, at school, we were chatting about our next, like, big thing that we were going to do. And a bike ride came up and wasn't really thought much of it, but then we came back to the idea and decided on a 300-mile bike ride around, starting at Addenbrookes and going around the East Coast back round to Addenbrookes.
So 300 miles, that's a huge distance, Charlie. Was it you or was it Mr. Payne, your teacher, who suggested how far you should ride your bikes?
It was kind of the both of us, because I was sort of thinking something a bit smaller, but Mr. Payne wanted to push me and something that really grabbed people's attention. So then we decided on a distance that sort of seemed a rounded number in a way.
Yeah.
And he's going to do it with you?
Yeah, Mr. Payne's doing the whole thing with me. We're the only two people that would do the whole thing, but anyone that wants to come along is welcome along the route.
So you start on Saturday at Addenbrookes, but then you're going off into Norfolk, I think. Can you give us an idea of some of the places that you'll be going on your journey?
So it goes around past, like, Norfolk and Hunstanton and all these different areas.
We've got down around the Market East Coast. And Hemsby, Aldeburgh and... oh, where else is there?
Kessingland.
Kessingland. So, yeah, there's a few different places.
And are you cycling for the whole journey? So you start at Addenbrookes and you're going to cycle all the way up to Hunstanton and then all the way around the coast and then cycle all the way back?
Yeah, we'll do the whole distance, so...
You're doing it over 10 days, aren't you?
Right. Yeah.
The first day, I think, is your longest day. You've got 45 miles that day to cover.
Yeah.
And then it sort of varies from day to day where they're going, depends on sort of how far it is, how many miles you've got to do.
And do you find out what happens with the money that you give, or does it just go into a bigger pot?
It generally, I think it goes into a bigger pot, but when we first set up the supporter group, they did say once you reach £10,000 of money raised, you can sort of choose where it goes to. So we put down for paediatric research, because it's so underfunded, all the research for brain tumours is. So, and there's so many worthy areas for it to go to, but we tended to think unless you can treat these brain tumours and beat them, you know, the rehabilitation sort of like, it doesn't, it's still so important, but we want it to be beaten. We want to still have these children here to get the rehabilitation. So, that's where it tends to go when we, any money we raise, it goes to paediatric research.
So, Charlie, you've got a big task ahead of you starting on Saturday, I think, isn't it?
Yeah.
So who came up with that idea?
Me and my mentor, Mr. Payne, at school, we were chatting about our next like big thing that we were going to do, and a bike ride came up and wasn't really thought much of it, but then we came back to the idea and decided on a 300-mile bike ride around, starting at Addenbrookes and going around the East Coast back round to Addenbrookes.
So 300 miles, that's a huge distance, Charlie. Was it you or was it Mr. Payne, your teacher, who suggested how far you should ride your bikes?
It was kind of the both of us, because I was sort of thinking something a bit smaller, but Mr. Payne wanted to push me and something that really grabbed people's attention. So then we decided on a distance that sort of seemed a rounded number in a way.
Yeah.
And he's going to do it with you?
Yeah, Mr. Payne's doing the whole thing with me. We're the only two people that do the whole thing, but anyone that wants to come along is welcome along the route.
So you start on Saturday at Addenbrookes, but then you're going off into Norfolk, I think. Can you give us an idea of some of the places that you'll be going on your journey?
So it goes around past like Norfolk and Hunstanton and all these different areas.
We've got Down Market and Hemsby, Aldberg, and where else is there?
Kessingland.
So yeah, there's a few different places.
And are you cycling for the whole journey? So you start at Addenbrookes and you're going to cycle all the way up to Hunstanton and then all the way around the coast and then cycle all the way back?
We'll do the whole distance, so...
You're doing it over 10 days, aren't you?
Right. Yeah.
The first day, I think, is your longest day. You've got 45 miles that day to cover.
Yeah.
And then it sort of varies from day to day where they're going, depends on sort of how far it is, how many miles you've got to do.
So have you been doing much training?
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of training. The most I've done so far is 42. Mm. So I feel like I could have got to that 45 miles, so I feel comfortable with doing it, and my legs haven't been aching too much the next day, so I feel reasonably confident I'll be able to do it.
I guess the good thing about Norfolk as well is it's mostly flat.
That will be a bonus, definitely. I don't think I could have ridden that far at 14. You've just turned 14, so yeah, it's really good.
Good. And have you got many sponsors? Have you got a target for how much money you'd like to raise?
Well, originally I wanted to go $1,000 more than my last thing and to get $3,000. But at the moment, I've got a fair bit more than that and I'm up to £6,000 on my Virgin Money giving page.
These are pledges just now, are they?
I think you go on and I've never done it. Dad's always done it when we've donated to anything. But I think you give your details of your credit card or debit card and they just put the money on there. People have been really generous.
Go straight to them
once you shut that page down.
And what is the company that you've organised the collections through?
Virgin Money Giving, virginmoneygiving.com. And if you just tapped in Charlie Nelson, it should come up. And Charlie wrote the bit about Reese and him on the page.
Yeah.
I think I've said that right. But I think if most people Google Virgin Money Giving, it should come up. And yeah, you should be able to donate if you want to.
Okay. And you're starting on Saturday, 300 miles. I think, did you say 10 days the ride's for? So on average, about 30 miles a day.
We have 10 days to do the ride.
We're going to try and make a bit of a holiday for you, aren't we, as well? So yeah. Dad will be there, and so it'll be me, Steve and Charlie, and my dad's going to be there, and Mr. Payne. So we're going to make it fun as well as sort of like hard work.
Yeah.
Got to make it a bit fun for you.
So good. And hopefully you'll raise lots and lots of money for the charity. Which charity is it again, Charlie?
The Brain Tumour Charity, Reese Nelson Superstar Fund.
And so, Charlie, in the future, do you think this is it? Will you be done with raising money after this?
Definitely not. I think I've got going to be doing one more thing in the next couple of years. Don't know what yet, but I want it to be even bigger than this one.
Yeah, I think you've got the bug, haven't you?
Yeah.
Definitely. And I think he'll probably do the, as he said earlier, he did the Christmas present appeal, didn't you, at Addenbrookes?
Mm-hmm.
Not last Christmas before. And we got loads of presents to tell you, got loads of presents to take up there and to give out to all the children. And as hard as it was being back there and seeing children still going through it all, it was, you know, it gave you a good feeling as well, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, listen, thanks ever so much for coming in, both to you, Debbie, and to you, Charlie. And can I wish you best of luck for your 300-mile cycle journey, which starts on Saturday and runs through until Monday, 4th of April, starting at Addenbrookes, and then going all the way around the coast of Norfolk and even into Suffolk, and then back to Addenbrookes, as I say, on the 4th of April. Thanks ever so much for coming in. That's a conversation I had with Debbie and Charlie earlier this week when they came here into Cambridge 105. Right now, though, I've got on the line down in London the Senior Policy Manager for the Brain Tumour Charity, Becky Shaw. So, Becky, on your website, there's some interesting statistics there. One of the statistics I saw was that 27 people are diagnosed with a brain tumour every day. So, by my calculations, that's around about 10,000 people a year. And another of the statistics on there says that about 5,000 people lose their lives to a brain tumour every year. So, how are things going in terms of treatment of brain tumours? Are things getting better, or indeed are they getting worse?
No, sadly they're not, and brain tumours are considered to be one of the group of cancers of unmet need, which means that survival rates are not improving. And when you compare brain tumours to other types of cancer, the deficit is getting bigger and bigger. And part of the reason for that is to do with historically, how much research has been done into brain tumours.
Now, March is Brain Tumour Awareness Month, and I just was wondering if perhaps you could give us some information about brain tumours. Are there different types of brain tumour? Perhaps some more worse than others?
Yes, you're absolutely right. So brain tumours do range in grade, and they go from grade 1 to 4, and the grade denotes how quickly they grow, how fast growing they are. Charlie's raising money in honour of his brother Rhys, and Rhys had a paediatric brain tumour called a medulloblastoma, and they are very malignant, high-grade brain tumours, which means they're very fast growing, and they are actually the most common high-grade brain tumour to affect children. So, yes, you're absolutely right. There is a spectrum of types of brain tumours.
OK, so that's an interesting point there. Does age or gender play any part in survival rates or how likely people are to get brain tumours?
Broadly speaking, no. There are some slight gender differences in terms of certain types of brain tumours, but broadly speaking, brain tumours can affect anyone, any age and any gender.
So what is crucial in terms of improving survival from brain tumours?
I think there's a number of things. So as a charity, we work on all fronts. So we fund research, we try to raise awareness of the signs and symptoms of brain tumours, and we also provide support to people who are affected. And I think it is a multi-key problem, if I can put it like that. So one of the problems we do see time and time again is that brain tumours are actually very difficult to diagnose, and we have heard anecdotally that people can often go to a healthcare professional a number of times before they're eventually referred for a scan. And due to the real lag, actually, in diagnosis of paediatric brain tumours, we started a campaign called Head Smart, which raises awareness of the signs and symptoms of brain tumours in children and young people. Since that campaign started, it has managed to reduce diagnosis times from over 3 months to 6.7 weeks, which is still not as low as we'd like it to be, but is an obvious improvement.
Right. When I spoke to Debbie and to Charlie, one of the things that came out from that conversation was that they said that actually when they went to see the medical professionals, some of them just fobbed them off, telling them that it was perhaps just a cold or so. It was only when they went to see their own doctor, who was much more interested to find out what the cause of the problem was, and he sent them for an MRI, that they actually found out that Rhys had a brain tumour. So is early detection an important factor in combating brain tumours?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Unfortunately, around 412 children under 14 are diagnosed with a malignant brain tumour, a high-grade brain tumour every year, and on average, 111 of those will die each year. of the people who survive, of the children who survive, 62% will be left with a life-altering disability. And so catching a brain tumour early is really key to better outcomes.
Okay, and is that part of the month of March's raising awareness of brain tumours, that you will try and make medical professionals more aware of looking out for the symptoms of brain tumours?
That's absolutely right. So the campaign during Brain Tumour Awareness Month obviously looks at awareness of signs and symptoms, and also there's fundraising effort around research for brain tumours.
Now, you said earlier on there that survival rates are actually getting worse rather than better. And I guess one of the issues is the amount of research that's done and, of course, the amount of funding that's given. And again, looking on your website there, I see it says 2% of the cancer research funding in the UK is spent on brain tumours. What difference do you think more money would make?
I think, obviously, more money is always useful. The issues around funding of research are actually very, very complex, and there are a number of reasons why research in this area has perhaps not progressed as fast as some other areas. Underinvestment is an issue, but also there are other issues around creating a really good research culture for young researchers coming forward, so that brain tumour research is an attractive proposition for them. And there's also issues around broader schemes that can actually help with research, for example, data collection and biobanking. So, of course, more investment is great, and we a lot of our fundraising effort goes into the research that we fund as a charity. But it is actually quite a complex issue.
Okay. Do you think there could be a time in the future that all brain tumours could be defeated? I mean, I guess that must be your objective, is it?
Yes, and that actually forms part of our strategic plan. Our strategic plan as a charity is actually called Defeating Brain Tumours, and we have a number of initiatives under that strategy that seek to ultimately do that. It is going to require more research, and that is why what Charlie is doing is so fantastic, because the money that he raises will be put to research, and in particular, of course, research into the type of tumour that his brother sadly passed away from, and that's medulloblastoma.
So on your website, Becky, it also says that June the 11th is National Paediatric Information Day. What exactly are you hoping to achieve on that day?
Yes, so we have a international conference called ISPNO, and we are holding an information day as part of that conference that brings together researchers involved in paediatric neuro-oncology, so brain tumours, from across the world, and that's taking place in Liverpool during early June. So that's what that's all about, and it's really a way of engaging and educating researchers.
Right, sounds like a networking day for medical professionals, so they can communicate with each other about the research that they're doing.
That's exactly right, yeah.
Right, and what kind of support do families need, and are there support groups that they can be in contact with to help them?
Yes, so we find that people who are affected by brain tumours often experience a poorer quality of life than perhaps in other types of cancer. And we do offer a suite of support services at the charity, which includes a central support information line. We have regional support available. It can all be sourced through our website. We also have, particularly for children, we have the Jake animation, which explains aspects of paediatric treatment to children and young people. And they're a very useful resource for families to look at together, so that they can understand a bit more about the treatment pathways that they potentially face.
Becky, thanks very much for coming on the line and talking to us this afternoon. Perhaps before you go, you might want to give some information to our listeners about contact details, website addresses, that sort of thing that they can possibly go to get some assistance and help.
Of course, so our web address is www.thebraintumorcharity.org, and on our website, your listeners will be able to find information about our fundraising if they want to get involved, and they will also be able to find out information about brain tumours more broadly, the research we fund, and of course the support and information that we offer.
Excellent. Thanks very much for coming on the line, Becky, and talking to us, and can I wish both you for your charity and also Charlie for his ride, which starts this coming Saturday at Addenbrookes, the best of luck, and hopefully he'll earn lots and lots of money.
Thank you very much.
My guest, Deanna Tyson, is sitting in front of me. Good morning, Deanna.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for coming in here on a bank holiday. It's lovely to see you. And you're here to talk about the exhibition Cultural Connections, which is in the Babylon Gallery in Ely, running from the 6th to the 24th of April. Let's get the facts out first. You're one of three artists exhibiting there.
Yes, we've all exhibited at different times, but together. And there is a definite link between us and our work, even though we come from very diverse places.
You do come from very diverse places, and you work in different mediums as well.
Yes.
So
yes.
John is a painter.
John's mainly a painter-poet. He works in oils, and they're absolutely fabulous Caribbean, really snazzy colours.
They're very colourful. That's John Lyons. Yeah, yes. Very colourful, very vibrant, yes. Aren't they? Mohammed...
Mohammed is wonderful. Mohammed actually is a typical artist, really, because he has his quiet, beautiful, extremely well executed, gentle oils and seascapes and still lives. But his dark side, his soul, the side that actually will be mainly in this exhibition, are his political pieces, which reflect his background and his upbringing in Iran. So they're mainly very, very dark etchings, and he has this fascination, a bit like Kapoor, of trying to find the densest and darkest black.
And this is Mohammed Djiasmi.
Djiasmi, yes.
And sadly, he's no longer with us.
No, desperately sadly. We obviously arranged this exhibition, and he's also a member of a group of exhibiting artists called Stray, and we have an exhibition in Norwich next month, in May. And he was going to do work for that too. And then sadly, he became ill, and quite rapidly became so ill that, you know, he didn't last until the exhibitions. But his family really kindly, and I think rather, well, I'm delighted, because in a way, people live on through their work and other people's memories of them. So by having the permission to take his work to Ely, that's a way of celebrating his huge talents and how much people loved him, because they really, you know, I have never met a man whom people say, oh, what a gentle, lovely man. It's super. And I'm hoping also that we'll be able to take his work to this Beneath the Surface exhibition in Norwich, because, you know, he was a much loved member of that group too. And he was just gorgeous.
A much missed person, but presumably as an artist, you know, his work is living on, which he would have wanted.
Oh, yes. He would be very pleased at this work, because it is his darker work, and I think he'd be very pleased that in particular is out there in the world.
So there's John, we've described the very vibrant Caribbean colours. There's Mohammed, who's got this sort of darker political side to his work. And yourself, describe your work, Deanna.
Well, I work... it's very difficult to describe, but... It is a kind of political stance. I work with textiles. I don't regard myself as a textile artist, because, like the Japanese, I paint on anything. And I choose to paint on textiles because textiles are an art form all over the world. People wear clothes. It's a much more popular art form than paintings on a wall, which are really for the Western world and, you know, very much related to class. And... I've taken the particular form of the kimono for a lot of my bigger pieces, because they're my kind of narrative tents in a sense. They're big. I can layer them. I can tell stories on the front and the back and the inside, and they've become my kind of narratives, really.
It's like a canvas to you, but it's a bigger canvas,
yes,
and it offers more opportunities for exploration, I suppose.
Yeah, I call them them arts on a moving canvas, really, because obviously they work best if someone's in them and walking around in them.
Oh, people do wear them, do they?
Well, they do, but I mean, mainly it's in fashion shows and things like that that you see them, because clothes moving are much more powerful than clothes static. And of course, the wearers take on what the kimono are saying as well. And kimono just means a thing to wear. So I'm not restricted to Japanese style kimono. I never use them with belts because I'm usually having the obi, because they're usually things on the inside. But I use West African gowns quite a lot if I'm making comments about West Africa. When I made a piece which was related to the barrier between Mexico and America, I made a poncho shape. So I take it as a thing to wear.
So how many of your pieces of work will be on display in the Babylon Gallery?
I'll have some wall-based pieces, but I'm hoping, if it works, 5 kimono, because they're quite big and they can take up a lot of space. So I'm hoping that these will be placed centrally so that we can kind of work around them. But the theme will link in, of those kimono, will link in with both John's work. For example, I've got a piece called Colombian Carnival. And then I have 2 pieces which will link with Muhammad's work. One is, I've been doing kimonos linked with the parallels between fairy stories and modern events in the world. So one of them is called Scheherazade, and another one is Double Bondage, which deals with the wearing of burqas, and those link very much with Muhammad's work. So I'm trying, you know, there'll be a mixture.
Because the press blurb about the exhibition says you use your art to come to terms with personal, universal and historical events. You'd agree with that?
Yes, absolutely.
When something happens in your life, or you want to comment on something in the world, you turn to art.
I turn to art, and it is, I mean, I have to say, I also teach, and I love teaching, because there's a huge therapy, particularly if there's something that bothers you or makes you very, very angry, you can actually work that out. And also, I mean, it means you can discuss with other people what you did. I mean, one of the first pieces of work that I knew Muhammad was very keen on was during the Iran-Iraq war. I made a carpet and 2 deck chairs of Bush and Blair, and this was a Middle Eastern prayer carpet. And Muhammad was thrilled by this because it told the story of that war, which I regarded was, I won't go into the politics, but as you can imagine, I wasn't very thrilled by what happened. And I'd made some postcards, and Muhammad said, "That's great. I can take these to Iran and distribute them where I wouldn't, you know, nobody knows where they're coming from." And it was telling the whole story. Likewise with the Scheherazade kimono, which he did see before he died. The passage I took for one of the images is a very, very dark passage from the Arabian Nights tales itself. So, you know, there are all of those kind of links and things which, well, I find fascinating. I don't know about anybody else.
Well, I think it's interesting when you've got 3 artists, how do you coordinate what work you're going to display? Because you want there to be the connection between the work.
Absolutely. So I waited. John and I are going to collect Muhammad's work, and we will select the work that we think will be appropriate. And what I would like to do is to take mainly the dark stuff, yes, and so we know the colour. But also I want to take 1 or 2 of his very beautiful, beautiful, gentle pieces as a contrast. John, I'm not quite sure what John's work is. I know it'll be, some of it will be carnival linked, because there again, you know, the history of the Caribbean is a very, very dark history. And actually, though the colours are very vibrant and there's huge amounts of movement in his work, there's a darkness in the story underneath. So, you know, I fit my work and have picked my work to link in with both aspects. But, you know, when you've got empathy working between 3 artists anyway, you can do it. It's not a problem. I mean, it's just, It's lovely. It's delightful to work with them.
And hopefully the work of one artist, if you're looking at it, will inform the work of another and you'll see different perspectives.
Yes. But of course, behind all of this is a little woman. And that little woman, I have to say, is Jeannie Rees, who's been doing all of the hard work that artists are usually hopeless at, which is the publicity. And, you know, she's super. She writes as well. So I'm hoping she'll be part of the workshops.
She is amazing, Jeannie, if you're listening. She is. She's a Renaissance woman, isn't she? She's John's wife, and she is a real powerhouse. So as well as this exhibition, you're also artist in residence at The Plough in Shepworth.
Yeah, and that's super as well. And it is, like anything else, it's difficult to build, but we've had a really successful and interesting mix of artists, and the idea is to have a mix of professional artists, artists, you know, potential artists, and community artists. So we've had school kids, we've had community, we've had some really top artists, and the group Stray is linked with The Plough. So we've had exhibitions of their work. One of the artists was a photographer who used to work for, well, actually, she's only just left the Jazz Cafe in London. So there were fabulous black and white photographs of jazz and what goes on there. And it's been a really interesting mix. And the last artist was a local artist to Shepworth, Sam Harris. And he had a really successful exhibition because he actually worked, he used it as an open studio, and he worked on his paintings in the galleries. So people were coming up and watching him work. And Robin Gom, who's organising all of this, you know, he's super. He really kind of wants to make people feel part of the art, and he really desperately wants to kind of make art important to everybody, but not, you know, he slaps my wrist sometimes because I'm kind of thinking, oh, well, you know, proper artist, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, it's the mix. It's fabulous.
It's not an obvious link because The Plough is, it's a lovely pub, but it's a mm-hmm. pub. It's not pub, the obvious yeah. place to have an artist in residence.
No, but then on the other hand, why not? They music is an art form. There's Claire McPhee has a poetry group beginning to organise that. It's the arts. I mean, I don't see any difference. But if something is done well and it's artistic, I don't really see the difference between art and music and theatre. They all interlink. And John and Jeannie have read poetry there, and it's been super. And John's recommended recipes for meals. We had a Caribbean party there, and it was... it was absolutely brilliant. Do you know Afrotima, the band?
I don't know.
Oh, they're local, and they play really brilliant music. So we had a fantastic kind of Caribbean night of music and food and poetry. And
that sounds wonderful.
It was really, really super.
And I suppose, you know, a pub is at the heart of a community, isn't
yes.
it? And you're trying to get your work to a wider audience.
Well, yes, and that's why I think the links are fantastic. So, and we arrange previews on the nights when there's live music, and so you know you can go downstairs and there are all sorts of different bands playing, and that's a real range of music and a super atmosphere.
And there be this barrier between art and people, that people yes. think this is not for them or it's too highbrow for them.
Yeah.
You put it in a pub and suddenly it's just part of the fabric, really.
Yeah, and
it?
Sam did really well, obviously encouraged by Robin, because he was working in the pub as an artist, and people actually saw, you know, what he was doing in terms of colour, why limited colour. You can talk about your work in that situation. And a lot of people were really, really interested in that.
Well, it's the exhibition itself, it's called Cultural Connections. Mm-hmm. It's at the Babylon Gallery in Ely. It runs from the 6th to the 24th of April. The website is babylonarts.org.uk, and there are some workshops as well, Deanna, is that right?
Yes, there'll be on the preview on the Saturday the 9th, we'll be talking about the art. I mean, I'm hoping talking for me means that we do a very brief introduction and ask questions, because I always think, well, you know, you might not be interested in what I'm saying about the work, but if you ask the question you want, then you get the answer that you want. So that's my kind of talking. And then there's a mask-making workshop on Saturday the 16th from, I think it's 2 till 4, and that is really open for adults and children. And then we'll have a final event, and I'm not quite sure what that is. It's called Don't Stop the Carnival.
No, it sounds good. Well, it's got the word carnival in it.
Carnival's brilliant. Because John's from Trinidad, so you can imagine.
Well, there's more information about that on the website, babylonarts.org.uk. And if you want to see Deanna's work, which is beautiful, your website is deannatyson.co.uk. Yeah. Well, good luck with the exhibition. It sounds great. I don't know the gallery. What's the gallery like? Presumably it's a good space and a nice light space.
Yes, it's a lovely space. Robin designed it, and it's a very attractive space. There are two rooms, and we use the foyer as well. And the next exhibition that we'll be having there is a charity event called Running with Brushes. And it's organised by a lady called Vandy Massey, whose son is in the army. And it's to raise money for young men and women who've been really badly damaged in Afghanistan. So it's a good cause. I mean, there are 10 artists who will be exhibiting there, and a large part of the profits from it will go to this charity. And then there are two evenings where for a ticket of £20 you get a drink, but you can also select a postcard sized piece of work done by an artist, you know, internationally. So it's a really nice thing. And then there's live music and the chance to have a meal in the bar downstairs, which is, we're doing these artist suppers, so you can book a table and have the whole thing.
That sounds great. When is that? Have you got a date for that? Sorry to put you on the spot.
The
website?
Actually, it starts the week after our exhibition in April.
Okay, so it's probably the last week of April then.
The Ely one, it begins on the 6th, so it's the following week. I don't know what the date.
Oh, I see what you mean. It'll be on the website.
Yeah. But it is on their website, yes.
That's babylonarts.org.uk. Well, good luck with that. Thank you very much, for breaking up your bank holiday and coming to chat with us. Yeah, and good luck with it.
It's been lovely. Thank you very much. It's nice to meet you.
I should introduce Chris Carr from the Hearing Healthcare Centre. Good morning.
Good morning, Ian.
And now you're joining me on a monthly basis to talk about all things hearing. We spoke about tinnitus last month. And this month, something for us funky DJs and something for some of my colleagues here who like their live music loud. We're going to talk about the damage that can be done to your hearing by loud noises, and that can be irreparable, can't it, if you don't take care?
Definitely, yes, very much so. I think really one can consider that if you look back in history, the first time we were subjected to noise as a problem was probably when the industrial age came into being, and we had all sorts of noisy factories and things like that. But prior to that, it was perhaps the odd bang from gunpowder, but we've become a very industrial nation. And of course, we've got our personal listening systems now that we all wander around with, which can produce quite a bit of long time noise.
They can. Hey, I'll tell you what, your microphone, let me just, I'm just going to slightly adjust it. Hang on a minute, because we're getting a bit of a poppy noise there. Speaking of noise, right, hopefully that's, hang on a minute, there we go.
How's that?
I think that's, hopefully that's better.
Good, okay.
Yeah, we'll let you know, sorry about that. So, in terms of, I remember I used to work with a fellow who was an avid concert goer, and I used to live here, when I grew up in North London, I used to live near to Wembley Arena, and he was always going to see very loud concerts. He liked his rock music loud. And when I knew him, he was a little bit older than me, he was in his 30s, and by the time he got to his 50s, he was wearing hearing aids because the effect of such loud noise had really damaged his hearing.
Yeah.
So in terms of that, if people like to go and see loud music, Is the damage that can be done something that happens over a period of time, or can it be as bad as you go to one concert and hear music very loud once and your hearing is permanently damaged?
That's a very good question. I've, over my career, found that I've got a range of people that I describe as from the tender ear brigade to the leather ear brigade. Those who are the tender ear brigade are likely to perhaps have an one-off experience which can leave them with a permanent problem. But I've equally come across people who've been through the Second World War in heavy artillery or tanks and they've got nothing more than an age-related hearing loss and no sign of noise damage. So, and it's everything in between. And unfortunately, there's no way of knowing in advance. So you only know after the event that you've got a problem. So the practice is obviously to use ear protection when we know that noise of a certain level over time is going to be injurious to the average person. So we're not immune to damage, whatever level we are at. And I've even come across army people that have only experienced one loud shot at a particular point in time, and they've got permanent damage, and yet they've been using, you know, rifles and shooting for most of their life, and yet it was just one instance that caused the problem.
So it's not it's not the case that because somebody's been around loud noise for many years and they've been okay, whereas somebody else can, I don't know, have something happen and then their hearing is damaged. It's not a case that some people are more resistant to it than others. It's just it may be that that particular sound affects something that can be affected, if that makes sense.
No, I think there is a difference in individuals as to their resilience to noise.
Right.
But everybody is likely to be damaged by loud noise if it's left on long enough, or if it's a sudden loud explosion, for instance. You can always get permanent damage just from one instance. And sometimes it can be just the conditions. I recall a couple of military guys who, as I say, have been used to using weaponry for most of their lives, and they can pinpoint the exact weather conditions of really crisp, frosty, first thing in the morning conditions when everything was really still, and one bang, and after that they've had a hearing problem, which they've never had before.
Wow.
So it can happen like that.
And when people do suffer that sort of damage to their hearing, what can be done about it? Presumably they have to wear hearing aids, things like that?
Yeah, it does depend a lot on the severity. It may just put a small notch in the hearing to begin with, but then if they continue to expose themselves to loud noise, that notch gets bigger and bigger, and it then starts to encroach on their ability to hear speech easily, particularly in background noise.
And in terms of your experience here in Cambridge at the Hearing Healthcare Centre, are there particular types of common things that you find the people who come to see you who have got, who think they may have, and then you diagnose problems with hearing, any sort of common things, any things that actually younger people now who are maybe listening to this, or parents of youngsters, you would caution them to be careful about?
Yes, very much so. The common complaint when people go to gigs like at the Corn Exchange or the Junction is that they come out with their ears ringing and slightly muffled hearing for a period of time, which recovers overnight, but it does indicate that their hearing has been temporarily damaged.
Yes.
And given continuous battering like that, it will become a permanent problem, and it quite often can lead to tinnitus. And I've seen a number of DJs from these places that have come to me for ear protection.
Yes.
And advice, because they've suffered some tinnitus, which is there permanently now.
Yeah, I know that in radio stations, it used to be the case that DJs could turn their headphones up as loud as they wanted them, and probably as their hearing became more damaged because they had them loud, it's a sort of a vicious circle, so they turn them up a bit more.
Yeah.
Whereas these days, because of health and safety and that sort of thing, radio stations have a responsibility, so most equipment is set so that you can't play it above a certain level.
Yeah.
So that's...
And the same goes for iPods and so on. There are design limitations that the modern iPod has. But it can be bypassed, I believe. I'm not an expert.
Yes.
But I do know that there, you know, these clever whiz kids can get around that and whiz the volume up higher than the manufacturer's limitations. And that's obviously dangerous as well, because they're sitting there listening to the music for hours on end sometimes, quite happily, ignoring the fact that it could be doing some permanent damage for the future.
I must admit that, on a personal note, I have an iPod, and one of the things that I've always felt, maybe this is because I don't know, not aware of having a hearing problem, but maybe I have got one, I can never get things like iPods as loud as I would really like them to be, and I don't think I want them ridiculously loud. But particularly if I'm in a gymnasium, yeah, and I'm using sort of not noise cancelling headphones, and they've got the music playing in the gym, and I'm trying to listen to a podcast or something like that, I could just do with being able to turn that sound up a bit more, and I don't seem to be able to. But you think it's probably sensible that I stick with the limits set within the device, do you? Yeah. That would be your advice, I guess.
Yeah, that's correct. The simple answer to that, actually, is to have custom-built ear molds to fit to your iPod.
yes.
receivers or earpieces. That way you block out the external sound. So again, the same thing applies to people wandering around high streets and trains and noisy places where they're trying to listen to their music. It also has the benefit of not annoying the person on the train next to you because they can hear the going
yes.
on. But you get a much better quality of sound because you trapped all the sound in your head and blocked out the external sound you don't want to listen to.
So things like noise-cancelling headphones, and I've got a couple. I've got lots of pairs of headphones. It's one of my things, headphones. I've got many pairs, ranging from some quite cheap ones to some pretty expensive, and I best not say the make, but you would know them as, you know, recognised as one of the best makes of noise-cancelling headphones. When I go on planes and things like that, they are fabulous because you switch those on, you can hear everything. So they are actually not necessarily bad for my hearing. It's just the fact they're blocking out the other noise that makes it seem... That makes them seem louder.
Yes, that's right. They're, and also, if they're full ear cover
headphones,
they are actually physically stopping some of the external sound getting in, as well as also using the electronics to mute a lot of the background that you don't particularly want to listen to. So you can listen to your music at a much more comfortable level and safe level.
So presumably, if people are listening to this and they're thinking, you know, this is ringing a bell with them, maybe they've been around a lot of noise in their life and they've noticed they can't always hear people or they're asking people to repeat things. What's the best thing to do, Chris? Is it come and see someone like yourself for a check?
First thing to do is to have their hearing checked because obviously if that's the case, they must have some degree of hearing problem.
Yes.
And that can be alleviated to bring them back to a much more social level by using good quality instruments to boost their hearing back up.
And would you have any... you know, what would be your top tip or any particular place that you would say, you know, if you're going to this, do this kind of thing, you know, for example, someone going to see a concert, how, because they can't ask the band to play more quietly, can they?
No, that's right.
Would you suggest people wear things in their ears to stop the noise damaging their ears?
That's right, yes. And one of the things that we do a lot of is musicians' earplugs, which are specifically designed to reduce the volume by between 9, 10, 15, 20, 25 decibels in a flat response. So you're not actually doing what an ordinary earplug would do, which is to knock off a lot of high frequency and less low frequency. So your music loses its sharpness.
Yes.
It's just like turning the volume down by 10, 15 or 25 decibels. And you can still listen to the music. You can still hear conversation quite clearly because everything is just muted by that amount. But you're still hearing all of the content of the music, but just at a lower volume level and a safe volume level. And we supply this both to musicians and to people who go to concerts regularly so that they can safely listen to their music at whatever volume that is being thrown at them, but still be come out without having their heads ringing and muffled hearing.
Well, that's useful to know. I mean, that is one of the services that you can offer, preemptive, isn't it, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's always best to prevent the damage. It's too late once it's damaged. You can't repair it. You can only use hearing instruments to improve matters, but you can't replace what you've lost. It's only there for the time you've got it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, listen, Chris, great to chat to you. It's an interesting topic. And if people want to know more... presumably, you're there to advise the Hearing Healthcare Centre. Just remind us how people can get in contact with you if they want to follow this up.
Right, they can contact us by phone on 01223 360 700 or at our website, which is www.hearinghealthcarecentre.co.uk.
Excellent.